My name is Meredith Stockman. I thank you all for coming. Nice to have everybody. So welcome to a panel discussion on the importance of culture in conflict resolution. I'm a practice development coordinator here at JAMS. I'm also an alum of Columbia University's Negotiation and Conflict Resolution Program. Our panel discussion this evening is a product of a joint interest on the part of Columbia as well as JAMS. We're thrilled to have an exquisite panel here with us this evening, made up of Columbia faculty members as well as two of our very own JAMS neutrals. The program will be moderated by Robert Davidson.
Thank you, Mom.
He'll also be serving as a panelist tonight. As I'm sure you all noticed on the way in, we have, or maybe not, we have a reception set up. So at the close of the discussion, please make your way in that direction. We'll have some wine, beer, and hors d'oeuvres. We have a really interesting and wonderful group of people here tonight, so please enjoy each other's company too. I'd like to turn it over to David Brandon, who will speak to you on the JAMS Foundation. So thank you all for coming, and enjoy the evening.
Thank you.
Just a moment to introduce myself, to introduce the JAMS Foundation for those of you who are not familiar with it. JAMS Foundation is a separate nonprofit entity that provides financial assistance to dispute resolution and conflict prevention initiatives across the full spectrum of ADR-related work, whether it's at the community level, at the public policy level, international and domestic. It's good that I'm here in New York to share the story with you. The foundation began following the 9/11 attacks here, when there was a tremendous gathering of dispute resolvers in New York City trying to figure out what, as a field, as a community, they could do in response to the attacks and the political dynamics that had led up to it. What they ended up doing was institutionalizing the foundation as a way of creating dispute resolution mechanisms and supporting those that do the same. That particular grant went to the City Bar of New York, basically to help lawyers sort through the countless claims that had arisen out of the attacks and to sort of begin to create mechanisms for processing those. That was the least ADR-related grant we've had since then. The 10 years since, we have funded about $5 million in grant funding to over 100 different organizations, both within the U.S. and internationally, that really covers a tremendous range of work being done both locally and globally. We are now at a point in our maturity as a foundation where we are trying to figure out how best to maximize the impact that we are hoping to have. That will likely involve sort of focusing in community arenas, on student and youth-related initiatives, maintaining our international fellowship program, which hopefully at some point you will all have occasion to meet some of our international fellows who are both emerging leaders and current leaders of ADR throughout the world that are brought to the U.S. to study, to observe our practices, and then basically to take that work back to their home countries to expand the use of ADR abroad. So with all of that, I am very happy to see you all here, happy to be here, and looking very much forward to our panel of presenters speaking to culture and its relationship to ADR and dispute resolution. And welcome to all of you, and thank you all for coming, and have a good evening.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Meredith. Thank you, David. And I'd be remiss in not thanking Todd Drucker, who's got the camera there, who was a real moving force behind this entire program. I'm Bob Davidson, and I've had the pleasure of being with JAMS now for about 9 years after retiring from a law firm. And I've had also the pleasure of a lot of cross-cultural mediation as well as arbitration in these 9 years. And let me start by introducing the panel. I'll say a few words, and then I'll try to prompt or some discussion by asking some questions of our panelists. And I think what we might do, with everyone's permission, is allow questions from the floor. So at a suitable time, you don't have to wait till the whole program is finished, or even when the speaker is finished. If you feel that there's something interesting that you want to ask, go ahead. I reserve the right to get the hook and say, Let's get it back to the speakers. I'm supposed to keep this moving, but
feel free. Can I mention that the acoustics are not awfully good in here? There's a lot of noise coming from the AC unit. I can just hear you.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know if people in the back.
I will speak up in my theatrical voice and to the balcony. Maybe we could do something about the blower. I don't know. But in any event, if you cannot hear anybody, raise your hand, and we'll take that as a signal first, or go like this or something, you know, which means louder, or this, okay, as opposed to this, and then I'll call on you, okay? It's kind of like an auction, you know. All right, we have the panel going in order here. We have Jeff Thompson on the end. Jeff is a New York Police Department detective who's currently on academic leave as a research fellow at Columbia University Law School. He's researching crisis and hostage negotiations. None of you can leave. Jeff is also a professional mediator and a PhD candidate at Griffith University Law School. He's a certified international mediator. His law enforcement role includes being a communication and conflict specialist, interfaith dialogue, developing and implementing community engagement programs, social media engagement, and designing training workshops. So he received his master's in negotiation and dispute resolution from the Creighton University School of Law. As a graduate, he's a PhD candidate currently at Griffith University Law School. Well, this is Eve. Is this on?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. Okay. Next to Jeff is Beth Fisher Yoshida. Dr. Fisher Yoshida is a facilitator, educator, mediator, and executive coach who partners with clients to develop initiatives that will foster change, resulting in improved communication, organizational performance, and quality of life. She is a director and faculty, and the faculty, of the Master of Science in Negotiation and Conflict Resolution in the School of Continuing Education at Columbia. She's the co-chair of the Advanced Consortium for Cooperation, Conflict, and Complexity at the Earth Institute at Columbia. That's an interesting credential. And as well as your others. And she serves on the boards of the CMM Institute for Personal and Social Evolution and Human Dignity and it says Humiliation Studies.
Humiliation Studies, that's right.
I want to hear more about that. Next to Beth, Aldo Civico is the founder and director of the International Institute for Peace at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey, where he's an assistant professor in anthropology. Over the last 20 years, Aldo has served as a strategic advisor and conflict resolution facilitator to organizations and communities in Italy, Haiti, Mexico, and Colombia, not the university. Since 2001, he's been involved in research and conflict resolution work in Colombia on issues of political violence and organized crime. He's carried out challenging ethnography about the paramilitary drug trafficking and forced displacement issues there. From 2007 to 2010, he served as a director of the Center for International Conflict Resolution at Columbia University, where he taught classes in theories and methods of international conflict resolution and genocide prevention. Aldo holds a master's and a PhD in anthropology from Columbia University and a laurea in political science from the University of Bologna in Italy. Margaret Shaw, our own Margaret Shaw, is widely respected for her persistence and creativity in reaching settlement. She's participated in the resolution of literally thousands of disputes nationwide. A former civil litigator, Margaret has maintained an active ADR practice for almost 30 years. She's the author of numerous articles on a variety of aspects of the ADR field. She joined JAMS when ADR Associates, a firm she co-founded, merged with JAMS in 2004. I think we met each other because I joined JAMS at exactly that same time. She was also...
We did meet.
Margaret has a cubicle across the aisle from me, so we are constantly speaking about And I have a question about what to do with a mediation. I have somebody to ask. She was also for over 25 years an adjunct professor of law at NYU Law School, where she taught ADR and negotiation. She has designed and implemented systems for resolving disputes in private organizations, public agencies, and in over 24 federal and state courts. Additionally, she has trained thousands of professional students and volunteers in law firms and corporations, courts, government, not-for-profits around the country in mediation and negotiation skills. We really do have a stellar panel. Before I begin with a question for one of our panelists, let me just give you a couple of examples. I'm the commercial type who does significant number of commercial mediations involving international as well as domestic disputes. In fact, I thought I was in a cross-cultural mediation today. It involved the music industry, and if you know the people who populate the music industry, I felt like I was in a room with people from different countries. In any event, a couple of stories. One about a defamation claim for quite a bit of money that was brought by a Japanese company against the defaming publication, and there's quite a bit of money involved, and it was very important to the Japanese company, and the president himself, the CEO of the company, flew all the way in for this mediation, so that doesn't often happen. It was very important that this thing be resolved. We have a few seats here in the first and second row, so if you want to sit, feel free. His lawyer was very aggressive, had the case on a contingency, I remember. And when the client came in, they walked into the room for the opening joint session, the president of the Japanese company stood up and in a very formal way said, "I do not want money." I could see the horror on his lawyer's face. "I want an apology." And he shoved a piece of paper over across the table, which of course contained a written apology. We negotiated the language of the apology. That took about an hour, and the rest of the day was negotiating between him and his lawyer about what the fee would be. Another example, which is not as maybe more mundane, but this was an environmental type of dispute. It was a dispute over the manufacture and sale of oil derivatives and products. UK company and a US company, you would think there's not much involved there. And it turns out that there's a law, this involved the sale of the final run of a factory in the UK of a certain products. And it turns out there's a law in the UK that says that if you cease production at one of these factories, you have to go through a cleansing operation, which is a lot of money, and you have to dismantle the factory at great expense. So the final terms of the settlement involved, for example, the U.S. company agreeing to a longer term deal whereby they would purchase at a certain price this product from this factory, which would avoid the immediate need to take a financial hit on the environmental or legal impact of closing this factory. Now, you don't have to be an expert in the laws of every country, but this is something which obviously the parties and their counsel are going to inform you in some way, hopefully before you walk in the room and are not surprised by it. Now, in the non-commercial area, and our guests are primarily here experts in that, fascinating work. And let me ask a question of Beth, if I can. Assessing the role of culture within a conflict, does culture really play a role, or is it all about the dispute? In other words, in my example, I suppose the example of the Japanese executives as culture did play a role, but often it's only money that I'm involved in, and yes, there are differences, and people act differently and react perhaps differently to different verbal cues or stimuli. But in the last analysis, someone wants to get paid and someone wants to avoid it. So is it about culture, or is it only about the particular dispute that you're dealing with? And maybe we should hand the mic to you.
Okay. Well, that's an easy start. Okay. Is it about culture, or is it about the dispute? I would say, from my orientation, how I approach conflict itself, I think it's always has a cultural component in there. There's always something about it, because it's either the person who is bringing the dispute, the person, another person, another party is participating in it, the person is coming in as a third-party mediator. I think everybody has their worldview and everybody has their point of view, and even if you say it's about the dispute, maybe what's being mediated or addressed... Closer like this?
Like this? Oh.
Yes, that sounds louder. Do I have to repeat what I said before? It's all about culture. Okay, so that was a summary of what I said before. Because even in that particular setting, when you're addressing the dispute, however you want to define the issue and the dispute, you may not be addressing everything. You may be addressing what's being taken care of at that time. So I don't do commercial mediation, but based on, Bob, what you described, it sounded to me like there are certain issues. Is that me?
Yes, we just moved the mic away a little
bit. All right,
bit
maybe it's that with this. So there are certain issues that get addressed at that time, but it doesn't mean that everything's addressed. And it means that culturally people are taking different things with them and some things are still not resolved. So in the case of the Japanese man, see, I lived in Japan for 13 years and was married to somebody who's Japanese. And I remember one time when he was driving my car and somebody hit him. And then he got out of the car and he said, "I'm sorry," to the person. So you can imagine my reaction when I said, "You said you're sorry to the person?" And then this person thought they were going to get a big payday until I got on the phone and said, "No, you were wrong," and then we had another issue. So I think it's always has a cultural component in there.
Okay. Perhaps, Margaret, maybe you can handle this. How can a mediator be aware of and manage her own biases and stereotypes when mediating or addressing disputes? And then... is stereotyping helpful or hindering when resolving a conflict?
I think that it's am I doing this right?
Yeah. Okay.
I think it is, you have to be aware of them, and you also have to manage them, but they can come up and kind of manifest themselves sometimes in some surprising and different kinds of ways. I think that there is a fine line in some ways about being aware of them and then being so aware of them that it kind of gets in your way, or people get ultra sensitive about it and you're not focusing really on what you're there to do, which is to resolve the dispute. So I think it's always a very fine line about how you handle that. I think that one of the things that I think is always tricky as a mediator, and this has to do with culture, it has to do with all kinds of personal characteristics, and that is that we're all human beings, and people remind us of other people all the time, and parties remind each other of others all the time. And I think that the important thing I find, at least as a mediator, is to be very aware and to try to sort of take some time. We always have, at JAMS, we have a big mediation room where people meet originally, and then each party has a separate room, and then I have a small room. And I very often will go into that room and just kind of do an inventory and just make sure that I'm trying to keep on track both with what I'm hearing from the parties and also my reactions to the parties, so that I'm not letting that interfere too much. But I do think that there are times when someone has tics, whether they're cultural, whether there's some other kind of thing that are very annoying, and I think the best thing that we can do is simply be aware of what our internal feelings are, take a few minutes to just be aware of them, and then figure out a way to focus on what is really going on in the room in terms of the conflict that you're trying to resolve.
Beth, I was looking at your background, and the intriguing thing is the thing I almost slipped on when I introduced you, about the Institute for Personal and Social Evolution and Human Dignity Humiliation Studies, and it struck me that various peoples, stereotyping is obviously a bad thing to do for a lot of reasons. You can make mistakes, it's unfair, etc. But sometimes there are, or do you find, general rules about how people react to various stimuli from various cultures And you have to take that into account when you're dealing with these things.
You know, I'm just also going to echo what Margaret said, too, is that we're all human and we make mistakes. And I think that if we lead with trying to build relationship and showing empathy, then figuring out how to do that with different people around different issues and different cultures, I think that's a good start. I don't think it's possible to learn every culture in the world. And then, of course, you know, if you think about the distribution of cultural attributes of people within a culture, you can go crazy and never move. You just get paralyzed by trying to figure out what's the right thing to say in any particular moment with any particular person. So I think erring on the side of just saying we're all human and building relationships, and I know that from my own practice, when I take a step back and I'm not concerned about my role, but just being human with another person, then I think that really does help a lot. And if you make a mistake, you own up to it.
Yes.
I wonder if we could get sort of a better or broader elaboration of what we mean by culture here. And I would sort of like to refer to the expert on the panel, although with a PhD in anthropology, and I'd like to get them to think a bit more through that, or specifically through how culture influences the kind of very challenging media communication.
Is that okay? Yeah. The interesting thing that is that the more you concentrate on a notion, the more that notion disappears, right? So the more you try to define culture, the more you get lost in the definition and you don't come up with a serious one. But I think that if we think of culture when it comes to conflict, rightly Beth said that it, everything is culture, because when we talk about culture, it's not about saying I'm an Italian, I'm an American, I'm a Muslim, or I'm a Catholic, right? It is really what distinguishes us as a human being. We constantly create and give meaning to our experiences, and that's really what culture is, right? So even if a dispute is about an interest, even that, you know, the weight and the interpretation I give to the importance of that interest is really culturally determined, right? It's enough to think that 3/4 of our brain is developed after we are born, actually. Right, and that means that it is actually affected incredibly by the natural environment in which we live, but also by the cultural environment. It's the experience that we pick up as we go along that actually makes us the human beings that we are and that we interpret. And all of that has a huge effect in how we define our experience. So I personally like the definition of culture that Clifford Geertz gives, who sees us ourselves as part of webs of significance in which we are ourselves are creating and spinning constantly, right? So on one hand, we are in environments that determine us, right, because we come from a previous world pre-existent and a pre-existent reality, but at the same time, we contribute to that reality. And I think that that's really important when it comes to conflict resolution, not so much to understand if someone is Italian, Muslim, Colombian, or Irish, like in my case with my accent, but it is more a question of how is this person actually interpreting the experience, the conflict? What is it that creates that intensity of emotion? Why is that interest so important for it? You know, maybe it's a dispute about land, but it's not really about land. That land is a metaphor for identity, for significance. It remembers you who you are collectively as a people, for example, right? That's a form of dispute that you have, of conflict that you can have, especially between oil multinational companies and indigenous people, right? It's a completely different understanding of the cosmos, of land, of exploitation of land, and of resources, right? Unless we are able to understand the different meaning we give to our own experience, we are not able to connect with the parties. We are not able to connect with the problem at hand. I don't know if that's enough as a... So I would never talk about culture as if something that is something concrete, an object that you can describe, right? Culture is something very flexible. We are constantly defining and changing culture, right? We are never the same person. Over years, we changed completely, right? There are lots of variation about within America itself, right? It's difficult to say there is the American culture. Just look at Washington these days, right? There's not the American culture. It's quite different, the interpretation that we give, though we share the same heritage and the same history, right? So it's always something flexible, something that is becoming constantly. And it's not something that it's has fixed boundaries that is objectifying. So I always like to talk about cultures, right, and culture with a small c, so that we don't make it this super ego for us.
One of the other things I was just going to mention is that we're talking, I think, a lot about culture and how we as mediators handle cultures of the parties who are in front of us to mediate. And I think the other thing that we ought to think about is that, and need to think about, is that there are sometimes cultural misunderstandings between the parties themselves. And I think that occurs quite often, and I'll just use, you know, how many times has it been that you've done a mediation and you've got a culture that is moves very fast, makes decisions very quickly, and on the other hand, there's a culture or a client, even though represented perhaps by an American lawyer, that just takes more time, needs to understand, needs to kind of process all of the facts. And I think that one of our jobs as mediators is to normalize that and to kind of be aware of the effect that that may be having on the other party, so that they don't, it doesn't affect the monetary negotiations or the creativity in terms of the negotiations, but rather it's something that you can help normalize and then, you know, just help both sides really understand what's happening in the other room. I think that's part of our job as mediators.
I mean, I was thinking as you were speaking, there were a couple of examples. Once a mediation I did where culturally, one of the mediating parties would make his point by getting his nose about this far from mine and waving his arms and sort of invading my space. And it got to be where the medium was the message, and I wasn't listening to him anyway. It just really, really annoyed me that this guy was in my face. And so I nicely, and thankfully he listened, told him that, look, when you're talking to the other side, I said, if that comes, step back a step. They're not used to this kind of presentation, and it may take away from what you're saying. He understood. The other thing is that, as I hear you saying it, Aldo, is that culture, to me, is a two-way street. It's what I bring to the process. And it's what the other side then perceives I am saying, and am I being effective in communicating that? So I can, for example, believe that if one of my parties is German or Austrian, they will be doctrinaire. This is the contract, this is the way it should be read, and this is the way it will be done, and I'm not going to compromise. That's my problem. And I have to be aware, for example, of this stereotyping that I am unconsciously or consciously, perhaps, engaging in. Because a lot of these stereotypes, as we all know, don't work. Or if they do work, they don't work in the way that I, as the speaker, think they are going to work. People perceive differently as well as speak differently. The other thing I want to get to is the importance of understanding. This is one of my favorites, nonverbal communication. That there's a lot of this, and I'll tell a little war story. I was in my after college, I went into the Peace Corps for 2 years. I was in the Philippines, in the Tagalog speaking region. And part of the training, I think it's probably still true today, is an intensive language training. And you get in a room with about 5 volunteers, and there's a Filipino Tagalog speaker, and you walk in the room. It's like what Berlitz used to be. They walk in the room, and they go, "Maga nang umaga." And you go, "What?" And you say, no, "Maga nang." And you're only allowed to speak back in the language that you're spoken to. Well, one day, we had a very attractive Filipino teacher, and she stands in front of the 5 of us, and she goes in Tagalog. She says, "First," right? Everyone laughs. She's like, "This, what's so funny?" Right? And everyone's a little embarrassed, you know. So I said, "Well, that's really an obscene sign in our culture or language. And she went, she giggled, and she went, ooh. She said, this is the obscene side, where she comes from. So we all learned that if you're in front of a class of kids teaching school, you don't go first. You go first, and then they'll understand. So that's just perhaps an amusing example, but I think it gets out of hand sometimes when people do engage in it. And I know, Jeff, you've done some research on this.
Yes,
sir.
Would
you like to share some of your thoughts?
Sure. Thank you. And I think a lot of what I'll just share briefly resonates deeply with what the rest of the panel's already been saying, and I appreciate Bob giving me the opportunity to speak, because I think I've been researching this for almost 3 years now, so I'd like to, I enjoy talking about it, and I know there's some people out there that's heard some of this, and it's funny because I'm researching nonverbal communication, yet I like to talk about it, so go figure. My jokes only get worse, so please don't laugh. So, for my PhD research, I was looking at the role of nonverbal communication used by mediators, and it consists of three studies. One, a survey that went out to mediators all over the world, and I guess one thing I'll say is, as we talk about culture, almost the frame of, and as Aldo was saying specifically, they don't, our cultures and our nonverbal communication don't occur individually in a vacuum. They overlap each other. And I was looking at the culture of mediators and what are they doing, what are they doing effectively, and what are they trying to avoid doing. Again, everything's overlapping, because one thing I'll just say real quick is with biases and stereotypes, well, one way that our biases come out, and it's quite often unknowingly, is we can be really sure and careful the words we say, but then what happens, there's this research term, which in nonverbal communication, there's a lots of fancy research words. Unfortunately, this word is called leakage. And there's nothing fancier than that, but I always like to say is, who thinks anything called leakage is good? Well, leakage is bad because in the sense of nonverbal communication is, it leaks out so you can be really sure of yourself that you're not going to say the wrong thing. However, what happens when you, and everyone reflects right now, regardless of a mediation, or maybe you've done it in a mediation and caught yourself, but when someone's saying something you don't like what they're saying, what do you do? Quite often maybe, and hopefully nobody does this as I continue to speak, maybe you'll lean back in your chair. Or there's other things, maybe you'll break eye contact. And some of these things, especially with the work that I'm not sure if anyone here is familiar with Paul Ekman, the facial action coding, the seven universal expressions, the facial expressions, those the research that he's been doing now for almost 40 years transcends individual cultures. And you look at those and you think about it, then when you don't like something or you squint in your eyes, and a micro expression, this is happening in less than half a second, quite often sometimes 25th of a second. And what happens is, especially in the mediation context, is you'll the negative side of it, you'll get where someone says, I don't like Jeff, I feel like he's favoring party A. Or you know what, and party B says, I really think he's on my side. And then when you ask those are what I'll call, you know, the macro traits, it's easy to say they're good, they're bad, or they're, you know, they're very neutral or impartial. And then when you ask, well, what did they do that made you feel that way? I don't know. Well, no, you just said you didn't like him. You felt like he was on the other team's side, or what did he do? You know, and think about it. I don't know, he's just a jerk, or there's something about him I don't like, and that's it, end of story. So what I've looked at from my research is trying to identify many of these micro cues that mediators do to build rapport, develop trust, display professionalism, but then also the opposite side of that. What are they trying to avoid to do that so they don't want to diminish any of those? And then so they, and I'll just end this, the three components, and I'm happy to share more about these crazy notes that I have all over here as we go through. But the idea of the research was there were three components to it. There was a survey that went out to mediators all over the world. The second component was, okay, so now I have what a mediator say they're doing. Now I wanted to know what are they being taught. So I interviewed from an ethnographic perspective to, you know, a deep, thick narrative from mediation professors and mediation trainers. What are they teaching in regards to rapport, professionalism, and trust? And then the last part, the third study, was observing them and saying, okay, this is what they say, this is what they're taught, what are they actually doing? And a lot of the results, some of the things I'll be happy to share a little bit later, actually specific examples of what they say they do. And okay, so what I'll just go through two quick lists. And specifically, again, connecting the rapport, professionalism, and trust, my argument from my research, and I like to think it's backed up with previous research studies, are the rapport, professionalism, and trust are displayed primarily through nonverbal communication. So out of in the survey, I asked them to list up to five. So they could have wrote anything. They could have wrote nothing. So the top 10 that the responses were number one, and I think some of the people here are going to say, Jeff, especially people that have been mediating much longer than me, keep in mind that this data just doesn't exist yet in the mediation world. So now there's actually data to back that up where we would all say, yes, eye contact. That came up by far. Over 50% of the people said eye contact, mediators, that was the most important way for them to build rapport with the parties. Number two was a grouping of different answers that I called warmth, you know, being friendly, being kind. Three was listening. Four was active listening. And I think many of us here, there's a difference between listening and active listening. Listening is just with your ears actually taking the information part of what the parties are saying. The active listening is more the affect aspect of where you build rapport and trust and include some sort of movement or some sort of action. We're number five, and I believe Beth already said it earlier, empathy. Number six, which I thought was really interesting because there's a variety of mediation practices and styles that people have, but number six was smiling. And some people have also said that they don't smile at all. And then seven was being equal. Eight, which I think is really important, and I was very, very impressed walking into, this was my first time in here. Eight is environment. So think about, all these little things, like is the room prepared? What's the layout of the room? That's something that I looked at much deeper. What type of table do you use? Where do you put the chairs? And I think looking around here, this is the model of, hopefully, if you can afford it, what every mediation room should be like with these views. And especially if someone becomes long-winded, you have a great skyline behind me.
Don't forget the food.
Yes, that is. And it's funny, people say that. And again, just the one last thing, and I'll go through the list of ways to diminish rapport very quickly, but it's the thing that I like to emphasize is, again, going back to the difference of the micro and macro, it's all these little things. And say, for example, is rapport destroyed if there's no food on the table? I think everyone, no. Is if you have no eye contact, as important as that is there no rapport? No. But you keep adding up all these little things, it creates a big thing where people say, I just didn't like him or I didn't like her. So just real quick, the 10 ways that mediators said that rapport gets diminished is being cold. And now think about the opposites from the 10 ways that rapport is built. And think about the cold, it's, you know, being distant, not paying attention. Number two was showing a bias, specifically with your body language. Again, think of that leakage of what do you do when you're not interested in what someone's saying. The other one is, and this I thought again was really interesting, is giving your opinion or professively expressing your expertise in the matter. Number four, I believe, was interrupting, no eye contact, being impatient, negative body language, what I'm doing right now, talking too much, and the last one, judging. So, thank you.
Very good. Maybe, Beth, do you want to make a comment? One of the things that resonated with me about active listening, I try to do that, maybe my stint in Asia, but I know, especially in Japanese cultures, if you're talking to someone on the phone, it's kind of rude just to listen, so there's mm-hmm. silence. You go, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yes, mm-hmm, to make the person who's speaking understand that you are, in fact, listening to them. And I will myself often do that. It doesn't have to be a Japanese mediating party to make sure, or I'll lean forward and eye contact so that they understand at least that I'm listening to them, not just hearing them.
So just two comments on the nonverbals. So one is that cultural nonverbals are so deeply embedded in us, we don't realize we're doing it. So when I first went to Japan and I saw people talking on the telephone, there's a lot of bowing going on. And I thought, why are you bowing? They can't see that you're bowing. But there's something about, it's just a habit that you say certain things, you bow. You say certain things, you smile, and so on. And then I also then take this and think about, how do we bring that into an educational setting where we're training people to be mediators, we're training people to be aware of these things. So the whole role of being able to observe and give feedback and sort of ask people about what's the impact of that behavior on you, did it invite you to say more, did it shut you up, did you feel that you're being heard or not? So all of that feedback I think is really good. And when we are in a learning environment, which is sort of like a little mini lab, then we allow ourselves to receive that feedback. So how do we take that out into the field and have a constant way of reflection and feedback? Because once we finish learning, in quotes, a program, and then we go out in the field, we're still always learning, and we still do need feedback, and we still do need to improve our skills all the time. Because I think we lose sight of what we're doing because we get used to doing it. How many of you drive a car, and if you were asked tomorrow to go take a driving test, would you pass that driving test? I don't know. We have a lot of habits that we've created over the years, and I think it's the same thing about getting feedback on how we are in interaction with other people.
I guess there's... There's sort of two things to think about, I think, too. There's our own nonverbal communication, and then there's the party's nonverbal communication. And I think we have to be just as aware of what we are projecting as we are trying to be aware of trying to pick up what the parties themselves are communicating with their own nonverbal communications. I think it's so important as mediators to kind of really listen wholly. In terms of things like, you know, in what order do people talk? You know, in what order do they mention things? How do they say things? You know, what is their affect when they say it? And also, what are they doing with their bodies? You know, what does that kind of communicate? Because I think that the more you can read what people really are, you know, be sort of three-dimensional about our reading of people, the more effective we're going to be as mediators. The one thing that, just about teaching it, I remember telling my students at NYU Law School when I was teaching negotiation, I had found a way that I thought was actually kind of effective to enhance our ability to read nonverbal communications. How many people have been on an airplane, and you know they always show movies on airplanes, and either in the mood to watch it or in the mood not to watch it. But if you don't have the sound on and you watch the movies, I can guarantee you it's a wonderful way to enhance your nonverbal skills. So I pass that on as a tip.
That's a great thing. Aldo, I'm going to get to you in a second. But this is really quite important, I think, to understand cues. Laughter, for example, from somebody can mean, you know, ha-ha funny, or laughter can be with daggers in the eyes, means not so funny. You can also look at people in a room, and if you have a large group, you can tell, if you're observant, who the leader of the pack is, who's not necessarily the person dominating the conversation. And I know your work with in Colombia to on issues of political violence and whatnot can be very challenging, I think, in terms of trying to glean from your people you're talking to what's really going on. Maybe you can enlighten us a little.
It's a matter of safety in those cases at times. You better get...
get it right.
Yeah, get it right of what's going on. But I think that... this is actually the physiology, you know, is very important. Not just in mediation. I think in every communication we have, and I think that when we are training conflict resolution, we are also trained someone in having this intuition of what's really going on through the mind that the body speaks to us. For me, I do think that needs a little bit of familiarity with a culture or with a situation. I think it's difficult that you are parachuted in a situation and you can get up the clues that are getting to you. So for me in Colombia, it took a little bit of time, little by little, to understand what really people were trying to tell me. But one thing that at one point I understood that was important to see if a situation was safe, if I could stay there, or if it was better that I would just leave a particular neighborhood or situation, if I was getting a sense that the bodies around me were relaxed. You know, when you talk to people, you can see if they're tapped-eyed or if there is some stress going on, if they're rigid, right, even though they might be smiling, but it's not really a fluent, relaxed body that you are talking to. And that's indicative that people are not comfortable for whatever situation. So I remember, for example, I was talking to these two elderly displaced people in a specific neighborhood, and they were telling me their stories, and I just saw that they were nervous, you know, even though they were offering me coffee and everything, but you could tell that It was tense, even though I couldn't perceive any immediate threat, right? And so I simply proposed to them that we continue the conversation the following day in a different space, right? And they very much welcomed the idea, right? I then found out that there were some paramilitaries who were just, you know, walking around the hut where we were, trying to find out who was this foreigner interviewing them and what they were telling, right? So I think you get these clues. You it's something that you feel as well. And this is the other thing. I think we need to listen to our bodies, right? It's something that an anthropologist friend of mine told me in my first conversation with her. You say, when you are in a doing field work in a dangerous field, just listen to your body. If you feel that your body senses you know fear or uncomfortable, just move out. Just leave the area, right? Don't rationalize. Don't try to answer question why is it or maybe it's not dangerous. Just leave, right? Because I do think that our nervous system has a way to capturing what's going on, which is much deeper and unconscious than what we have. And that, so far, has served me too, to leave whenever I felt that something was wrong, even though I could not identify, put my finger on.
Sort of interesting. In this context, and we're not talking about necessarily a commercial mediation or something like this, but in this context, it's very similar, almost like a psychotherapy session. You're a psychotherapist, and you're sitting in a chair, and you're not moving, and you're watching, you know, and half of your work is to listen, and the other half is to watch, you know, when does the thumb begin to fiddle, or when does the subject begin to squirm, or that sort of thing, to look at those cues. And a lot of what you do, I think, involves, as well as the others here, more than perhaps the commercial types deal with. I mean, it's much easier in a commercial setting to deal with money, because money papers over a lot of, you know, insults or whatever. Plus, you tend to get people in these mediations who are more sophisticated in a business sense, in a Western sense, that they're not offended by what would otherwise be bad manners to their compatriots. But in the settings in which many of you operate, it would seem to me to be difficult. Maybe, Jeff, do you have any experiences in a community-based or other areas which you could share that might shed some more light on the things that you have to be sensitive to in a non-verbal cultural way?
Sure, thank you. I'm not really here to talk about my police work, but at the same time, I could share an example that might have happened during my police work or a mediation that could have happened in either. I do a lot of interfaith dialogue work, both in conflict resolution in different capacities, and one of the specific areas are, some people said that I had a specific expertise with Buddhist communities, and having studied that for many years, understanding the culture, specifically the reverence that they have for monks and nuns in the Tibetan Buddhist culture, the Dalai Lama, and then also the different rules when you interact with a monk or a nun. And one of the incidents, I remember working with a group of people, and this one nun that I've gotten to know really, really well, I remember all the rules because, you know, the monks have, I think it's 90-something rules. Nuns have more than that for whatever reason. But one of them, I know clearly, is they're not allowed to touch men. And this is where you realize you're going into this situation. I was trained by some really great mediation experts and realizing, you know, don't disrupt or, you know, disrespect someone's culture. But then also I know the Dalai Lama always says, follow the middle path. Don't be one extreme or the other. So I'm wondering, all right, I'm not supposed to shake this woman's hand. I go to meet her, and she's like the leader of this group, and it was during a really tense situation. And I'm like, okay, what do I do here? I'll go and I'll say hi. Don't touch her. Don't put out my hand. And I go up to her. I go to say hi, and what does she do? So, of course, I put my hand out. And realizing that in certain situations, there were other times where dealing with like large groups of people where it's fairly potentially or was volatile or back and forth. And realizing, when we think about it, how important certain contexts And I believe, Bob, you were saying that too earlier. It speaks a greater volume sometimes than the verbal, especially when there's many, many people around and only the people around you can hear what you're actually saying. And there was a great study done by Amy Cuddy, and there's other follow-up studies up at Harvard, say not only, as we said earlier, what you're thinking leaks out, you know, your biases, it also works the other way, and how you act can change how you're thinking. And me realizing after reading some of these studies and trying to actually, you know, the other thing is empathy. You have to actually care. You can't go through these lists of things and do it, otherwise you're going to look like a robot. You have to actually care, because otherwise people will see through it. So in this one incident, there was a couple thousand people there, and it was really tense, and I'm realizing, all right, I need to try and help using communication to try and, you know, de-escalate and bring the tension down. And realizing if I'm talking to the one person and everyone in this room, if I'm... And now, picture, now that's one option of what I could have done, or now speaking to the same person here again, imagine what the difference is. The interpretation, I didn't even really say anything here, but just imagine I was saying, hey, look, I'm here to work with you here. Let's try and work this out where everyone gets to go home safe. And the difference of whether I'm pointing or doing open-handed gestures, and actually the one gesture I was doing, it's called the gassho, and showing reverence, because that's what Buddhists will do to monks. So I'm showing respect to this civilian person, realizing everyone here, everyone back there, and everyone back there has no idea what I'm saying. But if I'm speaking to this person trying to promote a culture of peace or try and bring peace back to the situation, no one will hear what I'm saying. All they're looking at is what I'm doing. And fortunately, it wasn't just me in this situation. Other people did it as well, and the problem stopped, at least for that moment, and things worked out. And it creates then that more of that culture of trying to at least create dialogue. And that's the only way you can work more towards a resolution of any sort. I have to be able to build that rapport.
Aldo, you probably have some pretty good stories about building rapport in connection with the disputes you've had to deal with.
Well, the... You know, I had this very senior anthropologist who was surprised that members of death squads would talk to me and for days and tell me their stories. And he said, you know, how do you do it? Why do they like you? You know, like to say, is something wrong with you, right? if you like to hang out with them and they like to hang out with you. And I said, no, I just cook pasta to them, right? And that's to say that, I mean, all... What you just said, right? If you really care, right? I mean, I think it boils down to that. You really need to create an authentic, genuine connection with the person, right? And so the pasta story is with this guerrilla leader of the National Liberation Army in Colombia, you know, 35 years fighting the mountains, and he was in a high-security prison. And I went to see him, and our relationship didn't start really well because I was given his email, which is another story, why in Colombia you can have emails in prison and laptops and cell phones. But I wrote to him thinking that he knew who I was and why I contacted him. Instead, he was not expecting my email, so he thought I was a CIA agent who somehow had cracked in his computer and was trying now to go and see him and extort information about his group. So we went back and forth. You know, I didn't know that he was actually writing me from a high security prison. So I thought, wow, up in the mountains, they're pretty sophisticated in terms of technology. They have some satellite thing. And then I was even more shocked when I heard that he was just every 2 hours emailing me from his laptop in a high security prison. And I explained to him, but I was, of course, fearful because I didn't like have a leader of a terrorist group pissed at me, and finally he invited me.
Especially one with a laptop and active.
Right, right. So, you know, finally I went to see him, and the meeting was very tense at the beginning, right? Because he thought I was CIA, and I thought he was a terrorist. So there was not, you know, a good framework to create a trust relationship. But the day went on, and eventually, you know, I tried to explain. We spent a day together, and then I left. And then when the second time that I came back to see him, we sat down in he had a kitchen in his cell, and he said to me, you know, I agreed to you to come because I want to ask you a favor. And, you know, 9/11 had already happened, so I thought this is, you know, material support to terrorism, whatever he asked me now to do. So I was uncomfortable. And he said, you know, I bought the ingredients, and I would like you to cook bolognese pasta for me, right? And so we start cooking together, right? So I taught him. And from there, a friendship started, which is still going on. And I helped him, because of that connection, actually transition from being an active, one of the most radical guerrilla leader in Colombia to be one today. Not only did he left his group, but he's a radical activist in peacemaking, right? And it all happened because we connected, right? And I could tell many of those stories. What you discover is that even behind the worst persons, worse because you define that as well, right? The people that you call terrorists or gang members or drug dealers or, you know, you name it. It's not true. I mean, they might commit acts of terrorism. They might do terrible stuff. But their individuality doesn't start and end with those. They are much more than just that. And they have the same human needs that I have. So I remember, for example, I was sitting down with this member of a death squad, you know, 24 years old, and he was very graphic in that moment of the interview, telling me how he tortured and killed, you know, hundreds of people. And I wanted just to leave, you know. I was disgusted, right? And then, you know, the thought occurred to me, you know, it's very easy for me to be disgusted of all of this because I have a nice life in New York, right? And I was never in a situation or in an environment where I would have to be a man, to be someone, to have a meaning in life, to make it, to have to join such a group and learn to do horrible stuff, right? But I and this guy had the same human need of being significant for someone else, for themselves, right? When I understood that, then I was able to connect to him and not to forget what he did. I didn't justify, I didn't sympathize with him, but I could empathize and understand what is it that you were trying to do by joining a group like that, right? That I did by going to school, by doing a PhD, by teaching at a university, and which you just had a very destructive strategy, but that at the end of the day was trying to meet a positive intention for you, right? And I think that if we are able to go behind behavior, behind appearance, and go to the intention of that behavior, even if it's destructive, then we go to the core of what the person, what is the human need that the person is trying to meet, and that's where we find the connection, that's where the dialogue can start, because then we can find alternative strategies to meet that need, right? Like this friend of mine, I can say, who is a guerrilla leader, who now has a different strategy to meet his need for significance and to contribute to society, not through warfare and kidnapping, all of that, by being a you know, promoter of peace talks right now.
I remember, and I may be repeating this story in an inaccurate way, so some of the details may be different than I think some of the audience may have been there. I remember a meeting, I think it was in the ABA dispute resolution section or the international law section. They had a plenary section session with an Israeli hostage negotiator, and he was the one who actually negotiated some terrorists. I don't recall the incident, but it was, I guess, pretty celebrated at the time. Attacked in Jerusalem, some target, and then were chased into the Church of the Nativity, I think, where they all hold up.
Bethlehem.
And here we have 25 terrorists threatening to blow up the church if they came in and tried to do anything. Well, it's not a healthy situation for anybody. And this negotiator eventually, and I was triggered by something Aldo said, actually got something going of a rapport with the leader of this group. There were about 7 or 8 of these 25 who were real bad guys, and the Israelis did not want them at all back into Palestine. They wanted them out, And so, or if they weren't going to be arrested and this group is not going to give them up, he somehow sent a message into the head guy there, and they had a one-on-one meeting inside the church. And the negotiator said, listen, this fellow who was the leader of the group knew who these eight people were, and said, listen, Mohammed is a very smart young man, and I think he ought to get a PhD, and maybe in Libya would be a good place. Tripoli, I understand, has a very good university there, and it's about an eight-year program. And the guy smiled, and he said, don't take 8 years, he says. He says, it's a five-year program. And, you know, Mohammed's very fond of Paris. And that's the way the negotiation sort of started, with a little sort of coy humor going on that eventually resulted in a negotiated settlement, no destruction to the Church of the Nativity, and these eight bad people were elsewhere when it ended. So there are ways, and there are ways when you get in this situation, and the message was don't give up. As evil or bad as you think someone is, there is humanity usually lurking there, which if you can tap into is a very important thing. And the last topic I think I'd like to ask the panel about, and maybe Beth, you can address this initially, is how can the true needs of the parties be brought to light when resolving a dispute in an unfamiliar culture? You know, is it money? Is it an apology? How do you ferret that out when you're dealing in a sort of non-traditional dispute resolution mode?
Not sure there's an easy answer to that question, but I will give it a shot here anyway. You know, I just noticed a lot of idiomatic expressions are very violent. Give it a shot, take a stab at it. So I'm always cautious that I'm saying these things, but I shouldn't say that. So I guess I'm just thinking about, like, a lot of the consulting work I do is in an organizational context. And in an organizational context, you have teams of people with different levels of hierarchy, different roles and responsibilities, usually not clearly defined, which is a good source of conflict. And these are long-term relationships where people have to work together again and again and again and continue on, unless they make a decision to leave, and that's a very big decision because then it means a lot of other things get affected by that. So in these kinds of situations, in an organizational context, today, in today's world especially, there is so multicultural. There's so many different people coming together in this same environment with very different understandings of what it means to work. What does a leader mean? What does it mean to be on a team? What does it mean to be an employee, and so on? So then I really try to explore some of what that is and get people talking to each other and get them talking to each other in a context that's not the work environment. Because when you're in the work environment, there are all those cues to behave the way you've been behaving, which is what you want them to stop doing. You want them to try to behave in a different way and to hear each other and communicate with each other in that way. So then I think part of this is also training in your own development about being able to observe and listen in ways that an average person doesn't do. So part of being in this field of the work that we do is because we learn how to listen and observe in ways that are not typical. And so for me, after so many years, sometimes needs just pop up. It's like magic almost. But when you think about all the years of work and training and observation and all of that, then you sort of hone your skill. It doesn't mean I've arrived at nirvana and I get all the needs all the time. Sometimes I miss them. They're not as obvious to me. But I think that's how you start to do it. And they sometimes present themselves in different ways, depending on the behavior, what's accepted, what's condoned, what's not condoned in different cultures. But you have to attune yourself to that. And I think over the years, you develop a way of detecting what that is.
Well, I was just going to say that I think that, we have to also be, always aware, too, of the fact that there are the lawyers and the clients and the lawyers and the clients, so that it's partly not only trying to pick up what's important to the clients, but it's also sort of really reading the lawyers well and reading the relationship between the two of them. And I think that sometimes we neglect that piece of it, but I think that's just as important to any kind of settlement as anything else. Another thing I was just thinking about is in terms of just the listening and developing trust and the communication, I always think it's also important. I think we often make assumptions based on perhaps our own backgrounds or experiences or whatever else, to really, if we're sensing something that is going on, I mean, A, number one, to trust our intuitions about it, but number two, to check it out. You know, my sense is that, you know, we've lost you a little bit. Tell me what's happening for you, you know, or something like that so that you can bring people back in. Because I think that sometimes, if whether it's cultural or whether it's just plain that we're having an off day or we're just misreading something, we may go off on a tangent that isn't the tangent that is going to be the appropriate one to get us and to get the clients where they'd like to get to. So my motto is always check it out.
These cues are interesting, and I have a question. Let me make an observation about getting someone out of the environment. You have an employment dispute. You don't want it in the factory or in the executive offices. You want it in a neutral place, which is why these organizations, JAMS and others, have neutral places to do this in. And you never know what the problem is in an international sense. I mean, I remember practicing law in some places in Europe, Belgium, even France to a great extent. You have employment. That's a very valuable thing. You got it until you retire or you die, and sometimes you're allowed to pass it on to your children. And so to lose a job is not just, oh, here's your severance. It's part of your being, really, if that happens. But, you know, I find when I am mediating, no matter what it is, I am tired at the end of the day. And it's not just walking around and being a little stressed about, well, who's going to say what about what. It's watching and listening. It's like being in a seminar like this, except it's 8 hours long. And you're listening to tones of voice, and you're listening to, you're looking at body language, and you're conscious of what you're doing. But it's, whew, this is hard work. If you're an arbitrator, it's easy. You sit there and you look at your watch and you look impatient. What do you do differently in a cross-cultural mediation that you don't do, let's say, in a domestic setting? Because they're both exhausting processes. Margaret?
I'd have to sort of think about that right off the top of my head, as I think I'm aware of wanting to check things out more. Just make sure that what I'm picking up is really the appropriate thing that should be picked up. I think I go a little bit more slowly, perhaps, and carefully. I just want to avoid making assumptions, and so I kind of really do slow things down. I think there are some, especially when you do a lot of repeat employment cases or some other kinds of cases, you sort of get a routine and you tend to kind of go through what you do all the time, and I think it's often useful to just stop and just sort of think through what I want to do differently right now and how am I going to be more careful about this one, and just slow it down. Make sure that you're understanding what is going on and checking out the cues that you're getting and making sure that you're on the right track in terms of your interpretations.
Why don't you pass it down and see if people have thoughts about it?
For me, the situation is interesting because I never did this work in my own cultural setting. For me, it has always been multicultural, because I started this work in southern Italy in the anti-mafia movement, and Sicily is so different culturally and even almost in terms of language from the northern Italy where I come from. So I had to start already multicultural in that sense. And then I came here, which is, now I'm naturalized, but it was a foreign country until 2 weeks ago. And then in Colombia, and more recently in Syria, which was interesting because in that case I couldn't even pick the language. I needed to work through simultaneous translation, right? I think that thinking now out loud, one of the things that happens is that because you are not of that culture, and therefore you have less tools in terms of language, in terms of cues, in terms of you are slower and you talk less, and so you use lesser words and you listen more. I think that's what really comes out from being in a completely different environment, and I think that's actually very good. because we facilitate, right? We don't dominate a dynamic. We help it. So we shouldn't actually be true to verbal in that sense. I stop because
talking about that going through a translator. How do you frame what's coming out from the translator and what's coming out from the person that you're trying to mediate?
Yeah.
Because there's a filter involved and it creates a problem, at least for me, to determine whether or not I'm dealing with the translator or I'm dealing with the person themselves.
Yeah, who do you, for example, who do you look at while the translator is translating?
Yeah, so actually, so there is the simultaneous translation and then there is the consecutive translation, right? Interpretation. So this is actually a great question. I discovered, for example, that when I have consecutive translation, it gives me time to think of what I say next, right? You improvise a little bit more because you have the time of the translation that gives you. And you pick up a lot of clues from the nonverbal communication. You hear the sound and you see how the body moves, and that gives you actually a lot of context for whatever the translator then says, right? For simultaneous translation, you don't see the translator; you have earphones. So I personally try to get lost in the person who I'm talking to or I'm listening to, right? And I saw that you almost forget that someone is translating. And I describe it almost as sort of a trance kind of experience, because you connect so deeply it's the only way you can connect with a person is that you give the physical cues that you are actually with this person as it is talking. And if I can just 30 seconds, I was in Syria talking to a woman who was a judge and with chador and everything. And I had just finished my introduction, and she just, you know, burst out in telling me the horrible story that her own town passed and how she lost the two brothers and all of that. And there was really no answer. You know, it was so overwhelming in terms of the tragedy that for me the skill in that moment was not to be captured and kidnapped by the horrors she was telling me so that I could keep the right distance, being empathetic but not being caught in this situation so that I couldn't do anything, and just listening. I didn't have any answer, you know, and when she was finished, she was finished. For me, it was interesting that, and it is all through simultaneous translation. For me, it was interesting that at the end of the session, she came up to me and she said, "I thank you for coming to my country, and you gave me peace today," right? I didn't do anything but listening, right? So I think that sometimes those obstacles make us more sensitive to be there, more present with our whole being and not just with our brain and the words that are at times very rational but tend to exclude other parts that are very important of the communication.
I have two comments. One is working cross-culturally, pay attention to the pace. So I come from New York, and it's like, blah, 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 3-second pause, it's my turn, obviously, because you have nothing else to say, because 3 seconds have passed and you've been quiet. Well, in the rest of the world, it's a little more than 3 seconds, so you have to learn that. And I remember being in Japan, being physically distressed, because I didn't know if it was my turn or not in a conversation, because the pacing was so different. I think pay attention to things like coffee breaks and tea breaks, because for some cultures that's a very important part of the process, and you build rapport through the coffee. And I'm just thinking about a situation. I was in Jordan, and I was working with a colleague and translating, and I would say something what I thought was very short, and he would go on and on and on and on in Arabic. I'm like, what is he talking about? That has nothing to do, I think, with what I just said. And the opposite would be, I'd say something that I really wanted him to explain, and he'd say, "Bruh." And after, I would say to him, like, what's up with you? Like, what are you talking about? Like, do I really need to even be here in this conversation? Because I really have no idea what you're... So there has to be a lot of trust in the person who's interpreting, because you don't have any idea what they're really saying. So there has to be that trusting relationship.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll just say something briefly, just add into that. And one of the things that I'm trying to do with the different researches that I'm doing is bringing what research has said and connecting it with practitioners, because quite often there's that disconnect or that divide. And just to add to everything they said is, it's been validated or demonstrated in many research studies, you know, calm, slowing the process down, listening, specifically like what I'm doing particularly at the moment on what makes hostage and crisis negotiators effective. And thinking about everyone here that's a mediator or negotiator, we've all been in what we've considered our own crisis situations, but these are men and women that are dealing in legitimate life and death situations. And time and again, they say, slow the process down, where it's even said in many studies, it's quoted as, time is one of the greatest allies of a crisis and hostage negotiator. And then another one is listening. In just a study I was just reading again the other day that they did down at Quantico, so the FBI crisis negotiation unit, with the difference between new negotiators and established veteran negotiators, they listen. The veterans or the experts that have been doing it for many years listen a lot longer than the new people, because they think, oh, I got to keep talking. You see everything that's already said. It's you got to be comfortable being in an uncomfortable situation, and it's not for everyone. And then just whether the parties that you're speaking with, whether they're speaking the same language or not, and it's even more important, your tone. And again, I'm from New York. I've traveled a lot. I know I speak really fast. And realizing when I'm traveling or engaging in different cultures, you have to slow it down. Your tone can really affect the situation. And literally, that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to help guide people when they're involved in a conflict. And it makes a difference. And the only thing is, I think we can all reflect on, the last thing I'll just say is, with the work that we're doing, we all joined it or involved in it for one reason or another, and it's humbling. And at the same time, I realize there's no finish line. There's no end of the line saying, oh, we won, because it's always conflict or disputes arise, and it's our job to try and help people resolve it in the most peaceful way possible.
I was just going to expand this also. I think some of you out there do a lot of training, and I remember a lesson that I learned years and years ago. Many of you know Carol Liebman, who teaches at Columbia Law School and has been in the field for a long time. And she had asked me through a grant from the Ford Foundation to go over to China and do some mediation training over in China. And we went and did some training in Beijing, and then we went to Wuhan, which is a small place in the middle of the country. And Carol and I are both very experiential teachers, and we thought up all kinds of wonderful, what we felt wonderful role plays, and we kind of taught the way you do sort of in this country, which is elicitive and you know, kind of experiential training, and it worked wonderfully well in Beijing. We just had a rousing success, and we went to Wuhan, and I was up at bat the first thing, and after some introductory remarks, I said, okay, now we're going to do a role play. And there was sort of dead silence. And it was very painful. A lot of the people who were in the, not a lot, but there was a good number of judges who were in the training program. And the last thing that they wanted to do was lose any kind of face by not doing as well. And I just, it's been such a lesson for me going through that experience to, and it just occurred to me that we should add training to the mediation, conduct of mediation, to this whole subject about culture, because it can be just as important in terms of how we communicate what it is that we want people to learn.
Let me just echo in my experience that being slow and being having time on your side, the way I do a cross-cultural mediation is a lot slower. I will look the party I'm talking to in the eye, and I will, my body language will reflect when they're talking, as well as when I'm talking, and I'm talking to you. And I want you to understand that I am listening to you, so I'm relaxing you, because you came into the room, especially in a place like this, thinking you're at a disadvantage. Here I am, it's not my country, it's not my style, my lawyer told me to be here, and I'm worried that these people are going to take me to the cleaners. So you've got to put people at ease, and you have to do it in a way that's quite different, really, than in a domestic setting. Are there any questions that the audience would like to ask, because we're almost out of time? Please.
With respect to what you wouldn't use when
Could you speak up so everyone can hear?
With respect to what you would not use when you have cross-cultural mediations, could one or two of you speak about humor? I know humor was mentioned earlier as a method of building rapport. However, when you have cultural differences, humor could often be a wild card.
Exactly. Very good.
If you can talk about that.
Okay, let me just say one thing. I think the implication of your question is correct. Avoid humor in the form of jokes or getting palsy with the other side because of some amusing anecdote. Because it might not be so amusing. It might be very anti-cultural. Do we have a volunteer for that one?
I'm just going to add one comment in. Sometimes people may say something like self-deprecating humor, and I think that's risky to do in a cross-cultural situation, because if you do that, they're like, well, who are you then? Why are you here? You totally lose credibility in that way. It's, oh, silly me. You know, I wouldn't do any of that in a cross-cultural situation. But then I wouldn't want to err on the side of being so gravely serious that it's like just very heavy and very intense. So staying light, but not cracking jokes.
Having said that, I remember there was a passage, I think, in, who was Reagan's Secretary of State, wrote a memoir or something, and Ronald Reagan apparently used to start every meeting, no matter where he was, with a little funny story. And they were negotiating this SALT treaty with the Russians, and and they had prepped him and everything else. This is what to do, this is what to say. It starts out with a funny little story that, you know, it was not funny to the Russians. And they're looking around wondering what's going on. So that's a pretty good example of at least what the staff thought he should not have done in order to start a productive dialogue.
At least
is there anyone else who wants to? Yes? That's something for anybody. I remember having a Japanese client once, and you hear the sound, something's going on, and it's not good. So it's an example. But anyone want to take that? I mean, Aldo, do you want to?
I mean, I think your question is great, because, if, for example, if you have to do with a culture like the one where I come from in Italy, we actually tend to be very theatrical, right? Very dramatic, and if you take it literally, you can be scared or think that's the end of the world or of the relationship or whatever, right? And in reality, it's just that moment, and it was to make a point, nothing more than you having had a straightforward discussion and maybe using some strong words, right? But it is important. I tell you this anecdote that Jonathan Powell told me once about his mediation in Northern Ireland. And they were in the thick of the conversation, and I don't remember who the leader of the Sinn Féin was in the room, but lost it at one point, right, and just burst into a show of emotions. And John Powell took him and said, "You never lose it unless you want to lose it," right? So in the sense, you use the emotions, even the theatrical or the explosion, if it's part of your strategy to get somewhere, right? But not because you are not able to be in control of the emotion. I think that's something that we need to learn as a mediators. It doesn't mean that we are always nice and, you know, listening and empathetic, right? I think there are moments where you need to be assertive, and if you need to shock the pattern that you are seeing, sometimes you need to be very forceful, and putting in some emotion might help to interrupt this pattern that you are seeing, that it's not leading anywhere, right? If someone is in a rant or something. So it's not only being able to read the emotion, but it's actually able to use the array of emotions that are at your disposal to help the process going on and to lead it in a certain direction.
So that's, I'm thinking that, how would you address that? And I'm just thinking of a caucus, and that Michelle Riley's here. We did a presentation last June at ACR GNY about the use of coaching in the caucus. And I'm thinking that being in control of emotions or letting the emotions control you are two different things. I would also explore with parties about their emotionality and say, what do you think the impact or effect is on the other party? Is that the effect you want to have? And then really helping them work through that, because if that's not what they want to have, or if they say, yeah, I don't care, let me just intimidate, whatever, then I say, okay, you can do that, and then what's the consequence of doing that? You may alienate the person further and not bring the person closer. If you want to bring the person closer so you get some kind of resolution, then is this the best behavior and so on. So really kind of a quick coaching process in the caucus.
Okay. Well, look, why don't we save the additional questions? We're all going to be with you at the reception hour, which is upon us. Do you have an announcement about that? Or?
Well, first, I think, you know, just love to thank Bob and the panel. So, yes, we will have a reception just outside in the lobby. You all walk through it on the way here. We'll have some wine, some beer, a bit of things to eat as well. Looking at the RSVP list for this event, there are varying different types of individuals here, lots of different backgrounds, skill sets, so we do hope you'll stick around, network with each other, and also connect with the fantastic panel as well. Just thank you all.
Thank you, Todd.